Welcome to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'm your host, Jackie Marie Beyer. Let's get growing.
Hey, everyone. Have you been to the Organic Gardener Podcast website and signed up for our email list? If you go there, you will get my new PDF, 7 Awesome Ways to Find More Time in Your Garden. And it's just some tips that I've learned from listening to my amazing guests who are always sharing with us. Did you know that you could support the Organic Gardener Podcast without doing anything differently? If you're going to buy something on Amazon.com, since I'm an Amazon affiliate, if you go to Amazon through a link on my page, which every book that is listed on my website is linked to Amazon.com, you don't have to buy that book, but anything you buy that day from Amazon will give me a very, very small commission. But I got to tell you, it would sure help pay for, you know, just some of the basics it costs to keep the podcast up there. So if you like what you hear and you did want to give me just a little bit of support, that would be a great way for you to do it. If you're already going to Amazon to purchase something, like I said, all the books are linked up to because I am an Amazon affiliate. And so just if you didn't know anything, you don't have to buy that specific book, but just if you go to Amazon through my website, they do still give me a commission. So thanks for your support. Welcome to the Organic Gardener Podcast. Today, I am super excited to introduce a guest who I've kind of been trying to get on for a while now. And it's a great time because I'm going to be running some replays of some people that I met at the Arrow Workshop last year. This year's Arrow Workshop is coming up October, I think it's 6, 7, 8, and 9 here in Montana. And even though I didn't actually meet Dave at the... So my guest is Dave Christensen. And even though I didn't meet him at the Arrow Conference, I heard about him when I was there and met somebody he works with there. And so I know he is just going to be full of golden seeds for us today. He's going to have tons of great information. He has some corn he's going to tell us about. So without much further ado, I would just please introduce myself, my guest, Dave Christensen from North Frontier Foods. And he also has his own website, seedweneed.com, seedweneed.com. So welcome to the show today, Dave.
Good morning, everybody. Arrow has been a tremendous help for me as far as connecting me up with people. I've been developing my painted mountain corn for 45 years, and it's been on the market about almost 30 years. But going to Arrow, I met other like-minded people and ran into other people who would grow different genetic lines for me. I'm developing several different genetic lines that I believe the world is going to need in the future. If not right now, some people need right now. And so Arrow introduced me into other like-minded people who are helping me develop these lines, because you need a different farm for each line to keep the pollen away from contamination. And you didn't see me at the meeting because I'm harvesting then. I've had between 6 and 10 different farms all over Montana where I have to be there to harvest, and I can't always get to Arrow, but I love those people and owe so much to that organization.
Awesome. Okay. Well, I just found out about Arrow really last year. I mean, it's kind of funny because I've had my license plates for 5 years now, but I just got them because I like the picture and the little blurb at the motor vehicle department. And then when Jennifer Jill Hart took over last year, she wrote the Farm Tour blog, and I just fell in love with it. And then one of my guests, Robin Kelson, who has this place called the Good Seed Company in Whitefish, drove me over going to the Sun Road to Great Falls. And I went last year and met lots of people. And then this year's is going to be in Kalispell right near me. So I just posted like a promotional thing for them, or just like a little blurb with this woman who's volunteering, Pamela Lund, yesterday, I think. I think it got posted yesterday or today. Today is Sunday, September, or Monday, Labor Day, Monday, September 5th. Anyway, so Arrow is a big connection. So I'm so excited to have you on today, because I met Ole, who I think is your partner, right? At the Northern Frontier Foods.
Frontier.
And
right.
So but I have yet to get him to come on the show either. So, but he was like, call Dave. Dave will love to do it. So tell us about, so we actually have, I think, some of your painted mountain corn. So Dave, you don't know, but mostly my husband's the gardener. I just kind of dabble and help him, but he does the like full-time gardening and he's really interested in growing like enough food for our family. So, or maybe not enough food, but just like all our produce and stuff for, you know, so we don't have to buy produce mostly at the store. So he's grown your corn before. He just grew it 1 year and then they saved the seeds, but then they didn't grow it the second year. We kind of had a slow start to our garden this year. And then we've just kind of been building all along. So anyway, so I kind of know a little bit about your painted mountain corn, but probably listeners don't know much about it. So do you want to start off right there and tell us a little bit about more about that?
Sure. I started growing painted mountain corn 45 years ago. We lived on the Flathead Reservation at that time in western Montana. I had a young family. Children were growing up. And I was a cowboy. I had a ranch job. And I wanted to do everything possible to learn about the old ways of living, collecting information on everything about life from homesteaders and old-timers and especially American Indians, and teaching all those things to my kids so they would not forget where we came from. And when my kids got to school age, we moved to Big Timber, Montana, because a bunch of like-minded people were all moving here to start a community. We called ourselves Buckskinners. We're mountain men. We ran around in buckskin clothes, hunting together, living in teepees when we could, and my family did more than anybody else to actually live off of the land. And we took our corn that we had grown on the Flathead Reservation and started growing it here. But because we lived kind of at a high elevation, about 5,000 feet, there was no corn that would mature there on time. This is back about 1976 that we moved to Big Timber. And that was before global warming. And we only had a 90-day growing season. And there was no corn that would mature in that short of a time. I tried everything from all around the world and found native corns that homesteaders had saved. The old homesteaders in Montana grew Indian corns. And I got corn from Indians who still had it from when their grandparents grew it. And at our elevation, some of those would mature. The first year it would be just about 10%, and the other 90% froze out. But I kept breeding those and breeding those and adding in more genes as the years went by to increase the yield and increase the protein and the plant structure, improving it in many, many ways. It was not my job, but it was my biggest life's hobby for a while until it became my full-time work. And I put my whole life into it in the last 20 years. That's all I do is raise corn.
So now the painted mountain corn is colored corn. Can you do the same things with it that you do with regular corn?
Oh, good question. Yes, it is colored. And the colors are antioxidants. They're called anthocyanins. That's a chemical name. But they have powerful healing effects for your body. They stop inflammation at a cell level. And they're also antioxidants as well as anti-inflammatories. And mankind never should have removed the colors from corn and made it all yellow because they're so good for health.
So that's something man did, was made corn just one color, just by only breeding that one kind or something?
Correct. Indians raised corn in all the different colors. Sometimes they would have a pure red line, a pure blue line, a pure white line, a pure yellow line, a pure orange line. Sometimes they grew mixed colors. Back in the early days, a family might have three different lines of corn themselves. This is from North America all the way to South America. Everybody in the tribe would have their own genetic lines, and there was so much diversity all over this continent. And then it all got lost when the way of life got lost. And there's almost nothing left. I think there's about 12 North Plains corns left in existence in the National Seed Bank. And maybe only 50 altogether for the whole nation. I'm not sure exactly, but it went near extinct, and I saved some that were not saved by anybody else. But there are different starches, different kinds of starches, to answer your question. Some starch is very, very soft and can grind into flour very easy. If you were to cut the kernel in half, it would look like chalk inside. That is the kind of starch the Painted Mountain has. I've selected it for that. Other kinds of corn have very, very hard starch. It's called flint corn. And if you would probably have to break it with a hammer. You can't cut it in half, and it just looks like a rock, a pebble. And that has other food uses. But Painted Mountain corn I selected for soft flour starch because that is the most usable for the most purposes. You can grind it in a little home grinder by hand very easily. It turns into a soft powder, and it makes wonderful cornbread. When you purchase cornmeal at the store, it looks like little bits of sand or grits. Mm-hmm. And typically people mix that 50% with soft wheat flour, mm-hmm. so mm-hmm. that your cornbread is soft. Well, with Painted Mountain corn, it is not hard little pieces of sand. It is soft, soft flour. So when you make a cornbread from Painted Mountain flour corn, it's already 100% soft, and you can use it 100%. You don't have to add anything to it. And it's the richest, best-tasting cornbread you'll ever have. Cooks easy, and it's going to come out blue. Of all the different colors, the blue predominates, and that's really healthy for you.
Excellent. So, okay. So, Dave, I usually do start off the show asking about, like, your very first gardening experience. You know, were you a kid, an adult? You know, who were you with? What'd you grow? Like, where'd you grow up? Did you grow up in the Flathead?
No, I grew up in Southern California in a rural community. I worked on my uncle's ranch. Nobody in my family ever grew vegetables. When I went into the Air Force during the Vietnam War in the late 60s, I was stationed in Tennessee and Arkansas, and we started growing, I was married, and we started growing our own gardens just because the other country, rural people did there, and we wanted to learn about that. But when I got out of the service and we moved to Montana, I got really serious about living off to the land and collecting all the information about how people lived before us. And I got serious about growing corn then. Because if people ever have to feed themselves, grain is going to be your staple. And corn is grain on the handle. There is nothing more easy to plant and harvest than corn. It's a big job trying to harvest wheat by hand. So I got real excited about corn. I'll just talk about my first Painted Mountain corn because that's what's important. I used to be a hide tanner. I tanned Indian buckskin, brain tanned it the way that natives did for thousands of years, and that made me very popular with Indians. I traveled all the United States learning how to tan hides from the last Indians doing it using bone and stone tools. And when I was done at the Taos Pueblo in New Mexico, they said they were going to send me some corn. So I went back home to Montana, mm-hmm. and one day I got a bag of corn in the mail, and it was sorted by four colors, red, blue, yellow, and white. And the reds were a variety of reddish-orange shades, you know, up to pink and lavender and maroon, and none of them were pure shades, but they were grouped in four different colors. And that was Taos Pueblo corn from 7,000 feet in New Mexico. And so we planted that for our first Indian corn crop, and only about 30% of it matured, the very fastest ones, because Montana is farther north, and with our day length, Nothing matures as fast. Metalis bulbo corn was a good corn to start with because it was from such a high elevation. It is also short season and cold tolerant. So our first year, 30% of the plants made it. And because I was hooked up with other people who were buckskinners and trying to rescue different survival skills from our forefathers, people started sending me seeds that they had collected from old-timers.
Okay.
And so I got hold of other Indian corns from the region and crossbred them with my Taos Mexico corn, New Mexican corn. And mm-hmm. I discovered the National Seed Bank and other sources and began right away growing everything I could possibly find that might mature in our climate and combining everything together. And it was a lot of fun. When you go to harvest the corn, you pull back the husk, these bright colors just jump at you, and you just explode with joy.
Nice.
It's better than Christmas, and you get hooked, and you have to do it the next year, too.
I bet. So interesting. So from Taos to the Flathead to Big Timber then? So you're still in the Flathead now, right?
Oh, no. We lived in the Flathead 4 years when I was young. We moved to Big Timber in 1976, and I've been in Big Timber ever since.
And where is Big Timber? Sorry, just like the middle? Okay. Down by Yellowstone? Or?
It's north of Yellowstone. It's on Interstate 90 in between Bozeman and Billings.
Okay. I just said, we're up by Eureka, by the Canadian border.
Oh, okay.
But then
yeah,
I teach on the Blackfeet Reservation in Browning, and I just commute I stay over there during the weekend, come home on the weekends.
Okay.
So I'm a little familiar with the different climates, but the Blackfeet were more like nomadic people. I don't think they grew a lot of corn.
No. There's none on record that they grew. I really doubt it. Lots of times in the early reservations, the Indians were given Mandan Indian corn and told to be farmers.
Yeah.
But in northwestern Montana, that worked. It took 15 years for the Mandan Indian corn to adapt to Montana's dry and colder climate. But I think that up around Browning would be way too cold. I can't.
And windy.
Yeah.
You know, the soil would just, it'd be hard. I think it's hard for them to have gardens, although there are quite a few ranchers over there, but I think they're probably
like
cows.
I think they tried it, didn't work.
Yep. Okay, so let's see. Where should we go from here? So then how big of a place do you have, I guess? Let's start there. Like, what's your place like now? Like, do you grow big fields? Do you use tractors? Or you just, like, have a small place for, like, your family? Or what? What
good
kind?
Question.
And you said you had several different places you're growing corn, right?
Right? Yeah. I'll be 72 years old shortly.
Oh, well, happy birthday.
Thank you. I'm single now. Family's grown up and gone. I spend so much time breeding corn that I have almost no income. I live in an old trailer. I have a few small gardens here that I do genetics on. And a good friend across town gives me a pretty good-sized plot where I can do 2,000 plants and hand-pollinate them every summer.
Wow.
It takes me 14 hours a day all summer. I don't get a break. I'm doing genetic advancement and bringing in new genes from around the world for different purposes. And that land has been sold. I may get one more year to use that, and I may not get one more year. I'll have to just do my breeding in a smaller scale at home when that day comes. But I have about 6 farmer friends around the state who develop different lines for me. And there's no hand, they don't have to do any hand pollination. But what I do is I give them seeds for a line I've developed that needs a whole lot more improvement, a whole lot more selection. But I give them the best seed I have. They grow them. I show up first day of harvest and spend a day to a week collecting the very best ears off the very best plants. And I save those to give them seed the following year. and then they harvest the corn and they harvest the best stuff for their family to eat for grain, and also some to sell at the farmer's market because it's so beautiful. And then if they have large acreage, there's a whole lot of grain for their animals, for turkeys, chickens, hogs, cattle, sheep, anything. And so it's really great to have those friends helping me do these different lines. And I need to do more of that because I'm coming up with more lines. And when I lose my genetic lot, it's going to be more important to depend upon other growers. And, let's see. I forget what your question was.
I just was asking about your place now, like where you were growing. Okay, so in the beginning you said something about, and I think my husband's told me this too, that corn has to be, like, you want each specific, what is it, like, variety to be grown, and it has to have, like, a certain distance between it?
Right.
So, like, how does that work? Like, how big of an area? And, like, how big of, like, does, so each person gets a different variety, so they are separated? Is that how it works?
Yeah, that's correct. Sometimes if a grower has room on their property for two different lines and has the energy to help me develop two different lines, I can have one grower doing two. It really only has to be a quarter mile apart or something like that.
A quarter mile.
Because the plants are so similar, there's not going to be really any problem if there's a little bit of cross-pollination. I do have some lines that I do not want to get any foreign pollen on them. I'm trying to keep them pure for a certain trait. The big problem is getting pollen in from neighbors.
Right.
And so all of my growers grow corn that's far away from other corn projects. We don't want any GMO pollen blowing over into our field. And when neighbor's corn is a little too close, it's usually sweet corn. And we have the advantage that my Painted Mountain is very cold hardy. I think it's the most cold hardy corn in the world because I've bred it to be. And so my growers can plant it really, really early, anywhere between April 15th and May 15th, depending on where they live. And then it matures very fast. You know, it pollinates and silks very fast. And so it's usually done pollinating before any neighbor's corn starts pollinating. So that kind of makes it easy.
Okay. And, okay, so I kind of sometimes, I'm not the best science student in the world. So, so the different traits, like maybe you're growing, like I get the cold weather thing, but like what are some of the other traits, like hardiness or flavor or like to do different things with it? Like you talked about the cornbread, some soft, like what would you use those harder versions for?
Okay. The harder starch, the flint starch, makes better tortillas because it's gummier. It's very hard to pulverize. If you grow flint corn, you can't just make soft flour very easily in a hand grinder at home. I don't have much experience with it. People say it's pretty hard to soften. But because it binds better, it makes better tortillas. My soft flour starch, people say they make tortillas out of it. When I try, it kind of falls apart. It's too fluffy. But actually, when professionals make tortillas, they don't try to ground the hard flint starch. What they do is they soak it and soften it and then grind it into a mush and then make tortillas. But I don't do that. But I am converting two of my lines into flint corn. And here's the reason.
Okay.
Because some people around the nation prefer flint corn. If you live in a wet climate like back east, I'm not really raising corn for back east, but I have people back east who want it, and people on the rainy western coast around the islands of Seattle or some places, it rains a lot. And flint corn will last longer in the ground without succumbing to the boggy soil. Flint corn will dry faster and not mold so easy. It's matures a lot better in a humid climate. So flower corn does very, very well in a drier climate, and when you get to a wetter climate, people say that Flint corn survives a lot better. So basically, all of the lines that I'm creating look about the same.
But they just do better in different environments.
Correct, right.
Nice.
Two of my lines have completely different ancestries. And I have not been able to test them all over the nation or the world, but the idea is that with a different background, some corn is going to have more resistance to one problem or another. And so I'm doing all this work, and no one's paying me, just to create survival type of corns with different genetic backgrounds. And the biggest difference in appearance would be the Flint starch versus the flower starch. And I'll tell you about two lines.
Okay.
Both of these are half-painted mountain, and one of them is crossed with corn from 8,000 feet in New Mexico and Colorado Rockies. Hispanic people have been growing them there for hundreds of years. At that high elevation, corn has to be fast maturing, and it has to be very cold hardy, and that's a desert climate. And so by crossing, it's a completely different race of corn than Painted Mountain, which is descended from North Plains Indian corns. So by crossing 50% of the genes from this high elevation southern corn, I just have a different genetic background. That ancestor is closer to the equator, and many people who are growing Painted Mountain around the world do not live as far from the equator as I do. And so this corn would be an advantage responding to the day length closer to the equator, and because its ancestors are a different race, there's going to be some survival advantage that I don't even know about. I'm doing a similar thing crossing Painted Mountain with Eastern 8-Road Flints. These are narrow-eared corns, which is ideal, which come from the wetter eastern coast of the United States. There's about, I think, 18 different ancestors that I used, and so this is a completely different gene pool, and I am in the process of converting these over, selecting so that they are all Flint starch, so people will have that option, and I'm selecting them to be blue, because blue has got a lot of antioxidants, and I have a very rare gene for blue kernels that also have a blue germ. The germ is the heart of the kernel where the nutrients are, and if that is blue, then you not only get more antioxidants when you eat it, but that all the nutrients and vitamins in the germ have the protection of the antioxidants right in them. So the seeds are healthier, they store longer. When you grind them into flour, the antioxidants in there with the nutrients are going to protect them. And starch is yellow. I'm selecting for kernels that have yellow starch because that's vitamin A. They have blue germs for antioxidants. They have a blue alurone, that's an outer starch layer that makes the kernel look blue. And also I'm beginning to add in the hull, that's the outer surface, that would be black. So I'm creating those two lines. Another project I have is the corn you first mentioned that Ole Norgard is growing. That's my black corn. I've been working on that all my life. I have a really exciting story about how I got into that. But Ole's corn is just loaded with antioxidants. I've found layers of pigment in corn that have never been known before, and I'm breeding them into Ole's corn. And he's making a commercial cornbread and pancake mix that he's marketing at health food stores and other places out of this high antioxidant black corn. And the black is really a dark purple, so your pancakes and bread come out purple-blue. Mm. It's really healthy. Because I've dedicated my life to corn, working 10 months of the year without pay, I don't have any money, and I'm living off of my own corn. And the doctors say that I'm 15 years younger than my biological age.
Wow.
I attribute that to, and I feel great, and people think I'm younger than I am. I attribute that to all the antioxidants in the corn I've been eating all my life. It's really healthy for you. And of course, the protein is almost twice what commercial corn is.
So,
then another, go ahead. I got other lines I'm working on. Go ahead.
I just am curious, like, is this like the kind of, can you eat this corn like corn on the cob?
Oh, yeah. Sure. If you pick it at the right stage when it's milky, it's going to be a little bit sweet. It's going to be very flavorful, really good for you. It's not going to have the sugar content that commercial sweet corn has. And what sweetness it has, it's going to lose if you leave it, if you store it. Whereas with modern sweet corn, they've got so much sugar in it, you can pick it and eat it 3 days later and it's still sweet. But people really enjoy eating Painted Mountain corn fresh off the ear if you pick it right.
And
but
does it matter if you have the harder flint one or if you have the softer flour corn, or either one you could eat as corn on the cob?
Oh, the flint corn starts getting harder and pickier sooner.
Okay. But if you ate it the same day, you could eat it like.
Sure, you could eat any of them, but
nice.
The Painted Mountain flour corn is going to taste a lot better than flint corn or field corn.
Okay.
The soft flour starch makes it more enjoyable.
Okay.
I'll tell you about two other lines I'm developing.
Okay.
I'm developing a high protein corn. It probably has the same amount of total protein as Painted Mountain. I haven't tested it, but there's a gene that causes your corn to have the rare amino acids that usually do not exist in grains. I think most people understand that if you don't have meat, like many people in the world don't, you can't just live on grain. You have to eat legumes because legumes have some of the amino acids or proteins the grains do not have.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this type of high-protein corn that I have is called floury, too. Floury means it has soft flour starch, like Painted Mountain has the floury 1 gene. So this high-protein corn can be ground into a soft flour very easy, same as Painted Mountain. But it has these rare amino acids, lysine, tryptophan, and methionine. And so you're getting a very good balance of amino acids. And I don't recommend that anybody in the world try to live on only one food. But there are many starving people around the world that only have grain. And if they have corn and it has all amino acids in it, they're going to be much healthier for eating only corn if they do not have legumes available. So that's a big project of mine, too. And we've been working on all these projects, special projects, between 20 and 30 years. It takes a long time hand pollinating to pull the genes out of corn from different parts of the world that doesn't grow in Montana and move those genes into a Montana corn. I might mention that Painted Mountain corn and my other lines are short, fast-maturing plants that are not good for machine harvest. When people grow acres and acres and acres of corn, they have to be able to harvest by machine. It has to be tall, have cobs high off the ground. Everything has to mature at exactly the same time. You can't have soft cobs that are undeveloped going into the harvester machine or they'll rot everything else. So my corn has not been perfected for machine harvest. It's still a hand harvest corn.
That's good though for people who don't have machines.
Correct.
And
it's
better
absolutely.
For our planet anyway, right? To get away from those farms.
You've got it. Because those huge plants, these plants that are taller than you are, that have these thick woody stalks that stand up for machine harvest, they're just sucking the topsoil off the ground. And native corn is small, efficient plants. They do so much less damage to the soil. And most people around the world that are growing Painted Mountain hand harvested anyway. So, but with my high protein corn, I am developing a machine that is on a machine harvestable line of corn. I got the ancestors from research experiment stations in North Dakota, Canada, and Poland. And so they're small, efficient plants, but they have strong stalks, so they could be machine harvested. People could grow this high protein corn on large scale. I am also crossing that with Ole's black corn, so that Ole's corn will stand up a little better for machine harvest someday, and it will have both the high antioxidants of the black corn and the high protein of the flowery 2 corn. Okay, I'll tell you about one more project. Corn borers are a worm, a moth that has a larva that will bore into corn, and it could destroy thousands of acres in a few months all across the United States. Monsanto has given us a corn borer resistant corn that is genetically modified and has the BT gene in it. That's a toxin that kills the borer when it eats the corn. Scientists in Europe believe they have proven that this corn with the toxin in it is actually poisoning us. We are not allowed to test that in America. Monsanto has the rights to evaluate their own product, and they told us it's safe. Well, if it ever turns out that Monsanto GM corn is not safe, the world is going to need a corn that is resistant to corn borers. Now, some people at the University of Nebraska found a corn in Mexico that is naturally resistant to borers, and they crossbred it to modern American corn. And a partner of mine, Frank Kutko, was at Cornell University in New York at the time, and he got that borer-resistant corn and crossed it to Painted Mountain for me. And then they ran it through a series of tests at Cornell where they inoculated the corn with corn borers, and then they gave me the seed from the ones that inherited the resistance. So I have been breeding that here every other year, self-pollinating it and selecting it for survivability in Montana, because corn from Mexico does not grow in Montana. We have to keep working to find ones that inherited the Montana genes but also inherited the corn borer resistant genes.
Oh.
So that's another project of mine. I'll be looking for people who want to take on these projects as I retire or as I lose access to the land where I can do my own. I basically am completing all of the complicated hand pollination and crossbreeding. I have created lines that need improvement, but nobody really has to do any more complicated work. They just have to adopt the line and let me help them select the best ones every year and teach them how to do it. And I hope to put all these in the hands of people all around the world. Well, that's already happening. My corn is being grown in every continent in the world, very often by indigenous people who live in difficult climates where they cannot grow any other grain. And Painted Mountain corn will thrive for them.
That's amazing. So then, okay, so I guess I got to go with the basic question. Like, why do you have to hand pollinate? And, like, how do you do that? Like, you take, like, pollen from one corn thing and, like, take a paintbrush and paint it on the other?
You got it. Why do I hand pollinate? If you just turn corn loose in the field and let the pollen blow all around, you'll get all kinds of combinations. It's wonderful. Out of 10 million kernels, there won't be any two that have the same genetics. And then you can go select the ones that are improving, that are moving in the direction you want. And that's a whole lot of fun. But that's kind of wild. If you want to do more, make more specific progress, you take your very best plants and you self-pollinate them. I'd explain this. Native corn is filled with all kinds of genetic problems and defects and genes you don't want, as well as good genes. And if you want to improve a line, the more plants you can self-pollinate, the better. Because 90% of the children will end up having a double shot of some gene you don't like, and only 1 out of 10 will actually have all the good genes. And so the more you self-pollinate, the more you're able to identify the plants that have the good genes. And so that's a way to move forward a lot faster. Painted Mountain would be a much more primitive crop today with all kinds of flaws and defects if I had not spent 45 years hand-pollinating and selecting the best. Then another, so actually in my home garden plot where I do hand-pollinating, a majority of my plants, I'd say 60%, are self-pollinated, as I described. And 40%, I'm actually making crosses. I'll have a plant that's got a brand new discovery for a color gene that gives you antioxidants, but it's not on the best plant in the world. So I put that pollen on two of my very best plants, trying to bring that gene into my population. When we are crossbreeding to the Mexican corn that has the borer resistance, you can't just turn that loose in a field. You put the pollen from the Mexican corn onto Painted Mountain carefully, then you know you have children that will have one of each parent.
Oh, okay. So
you're controlling what you're doing. And the way you do it, corn is the most amazing plant in the world to work with. It's really easy. I feel like I'm cheating. It's so easy because the male pollen is on the top of the plant in a tassel. And the female part of the plant is separated. It's the cob, the ear, on the side of the plant, and they're separated. So you can put a bag over the developing ear and protect from getting any pollen.
That was one of my questions. And, like, once you pollinate it, how do you make sure it doesn't keep getting pollinated by bees and other, you know, things, insects?
Pollen blows around the wind in 5 minutes in the morning. You buy these little bags. They're made just for this. They're little white paper bags, and they look like the kind of bags they would put a corn dog in, about that size. And when the little baby ear just first starts showing, the little first leaves and the first silk, you fit that little bag and protect the developing ear. And then you have a choice to go out and put whatever pollen you want on it. Whether you pollinate it with itself or you put pollen on from another plant, it's still the same procedure. There are different ways to do it. You can take a little tassel branch off of the top of the plant that has little flowers and pollen on it and break that off and just rub it on the silk and then cover the silk back up again. Or you can shake the pollen into the little bag that I told you about and then pour that pollen over the silk. When I use a brush, that's kind of for group pollination. I usually pollinate specific plants. But sometimes I'll have a whole population that I want to collect pollen from maybe 30 plants and mix it all up. So what I do is I go around with a larger paper bag and I shake the tassels into the paper bag from all 30 plants. And then I get a good collection of yellow pollen in the bottom of the bag. And then I pour that into a little plastic cup. And then I have a little brush that is made for a woman's makeup, a camel hair makeup brush. And I dip the brush into the cup full of pollen and go around and dust that on every little silk of every plant I want to crossbreed that population with.
No wonder it takes you 14 hours a day, because there's probably a lot of ears of corn in each crop.
Yeah, there is.
Okay.
But it's tiring. The corn is so close to the ground. I have to bend over all day long. And boy, that's hard on your back after 14 hours. It doesn't even feel good to stand up. But
Aww.
I tell you, it is so satisfying. I mean, I can't do stuff with my friends because I've got to pollinate corn. They know that every day all summer. They say, "Why are you doing this? You're not getting paid." I feel wonderful because I think that what I'm doing is going to be really, really important. Giving the people of the world a fast maturing corn that can withstand poor soil and bad weather conditions with the climate change accelerating, I think this is critical. And I get letters from all over the world, people thanking me profusely and calling me a hero because I'm feeding people that couldn't grow grain otherwise. So I'm in love with life. I show up in my field in the morning at sunrise, and I have like a Hopi Indian flute, and I play just a simple melody and watch and just feel the sound penetrate everything around there. It's a beautiful, beautiful way to start the day.
We need to write a children's book about you.
Oh, okay.
Before we get to the root of things, we're going to take a moment to thank our sponsors, my good friend, Dacia Daly from Simply Josephine.
It's all about handcrafted soaps and apron love here at Simply Josephine. Located in Montana's beautiful Tobacco Valley, I create everything from my home studio. Currently, I offer six different kinds of handmade soaps, three different salves, using wildcrafted plant medicine from right here in our beautiful valley. In addition to my body care products, I also make several styles of aprons. Everything is available at simplyjosephine.com. We want to share a little love with the Organic Gardener Podcast listeners. We're offering 15% off. Use code OGP15 at checkout. Thanks and have a beautiful day. SimplyJosephine.com.
This is Robin Kelson from the Good Seed Company. We sell heirloom seeds for common use. We offer vegetable, herb, flower seeds locally adapted for our area and all open pollinated and heirloom, a lot of them organic or ecologically farmed. We also sell seed collections to help you, to help new gardeners be successful in their growing. We sell flower collections that are good for pollinators. We sell medicinal herbs and culinary herbs, all sorts of seeds that would be of interest to new and experienced gardeners. www. goodseedco.net. We're having a sale right now on garlic and greens for fall, if you're interested.
All right. So we've been talking for a little while. Let's do what I call get to the root of things. And I'll ask you some of my basic questions, like, do you have a least favorite activity to do in the garden?
Oh, yeah.
Is that it or is something else?
Yeah, bindweed.
Oh,
what?
Okay.
Yeah, pulling up bindweed. We've got really bad weeds that have roots that go really, really deep, and you can never kill them. But you have to slow them down, or they'll completely take over. And I have a tool. It's actually used for asparagus somehow. I don't know. It's like a long screwdriver with a flattened end with this fork. It's got a little notch in it.
Yeah.
And you push that down into the ground really deep, and you get the roots as deep as you can. That slows them down. That's about all you can do is slow them down. But if you buy that tool, you can get them on the web. Get one that's got really, really hard steel, because otherwise it can bend.
Right.
Well, I don't like bindweed.
What's your soil like in Big Sandy? Our soil is kind of a... you know, a rockier, sandy soil here where we are. We have to really put a lot of compost and nutrients, manure and stuff into our soil. Like, what's your soil like down there? The Flathead,
okay,
I know, is pretty nice soil.
But I'm, in Big Timber. And
Big Timber, sorry.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I grow my big painted mountain crop is grown in Big Sandy on Bob Quinn's farm.
Oh, okay.
And yeah, so I spent a couple months up there harvesting in fall. So that's where most of my corn is. My big acreage is up there. Bob's an organic grower, a long-term member of Arrow. He's an amazing guy.
Yeah, I interviewed him last year, and it's going to replay next week. Actually, probably be Monday, and his will follow right up on Thursday, because I just kind of like started to like schedule my replays, because like I haven't found a place in Browning to live permanently yet, so my internet over there is very sporadic. So I kind of have to do what I can do at home on the weekends. So I was kind of going through my old Arrow things last night, and I'm pretty sure he was one of my favorite interviews. He's another amazing guy. But in Big Timber,
Well, my soil is 60% rock.
Oh.
I've spent most of my life hauling rocks out, and every year more and more and more. It's just a hard clay.
Yep.
And I think all the places in Montana that I grow corn, there's only 2% organic matter in the soil. It's not back east where commercial corn that they sell had its genetic origins in the East Coast, where they've got 6 feet of humus, you know, decayed organic matter. Out west in sagebrush country, 2%, low nitrogen. It's alkali soil, which is hard on a lot of plants. We have an arid climate, very little rainfall, and so there's nothing, no corn in the world that will endure dry land farming in Montana without water like Painted Mountain. So it's tough soil. And in some of my places, I have grown it without adding manure because I want corn that will grow in the tough places of the world. Many, many people in the world are growing on played-out soil, and I think it's beautiful that people do all these wonderful things to improve their soil, but I am a breeder more than a farmer, and I want to develop seed that has the ability to either produce their own nutrients or to produce good nutrients under difficult situations. And so I have stressed my corn out from day one, and I don't add manure to it until the corn gets so weak that I'm not producing anything. But it's a land that Cassandra Mitchell is letting me use her land in Big Timber that she just sold. But I've taken very good care of her land by putting truckloads of manure on. That's just really good for you. You can really grow beautiful Painted Mountain corn when you put manure on it.
Oh, okay.
It does wonderful without it, but it's surprising these huge cobs you get. They can be a foot long. Yeah, it's pretty wonderful.
Okay. So on the flip side, what's your favorite activity to do in the garden?
I think the truth is the actual thing is the satisfaction of knowing that what I'm doing is important. For physical activity, I guess it would be harvesting, because every year is like Christmas. You see color combinations you never dreamed of. Like, especially at Bob Quinn, we've got 2 acres. Mm-hmm. With that many years, you'll see things that you'll never see again in your life. Beautiful color combinations.
Neat.
I'm big into color. That's what hooked me into this whole thing in the start.
Really? See, it's going to be a beautiful book. I can see it already. So what's the best gardening advice you've ever received, Dave?
Can we go with breeding advice?
Yes. Yeah, this is exciting because nobody's really talked about this too much on my show.
Nobody,
just a little tiny bit, so this is great.
Yeah, nobody knows about breeders. Everybody wants locally adapted seed. People love the idea of heirloom seeds. Everybody wants to be organic. But heirloom seeds disappeared because they weren't productive or they didn't taste good or something was wrong and they weren't developed. And I think it was somewhere in the early 1980s, Seed Saver started. That excited a lot of people about saving old-time heirloom seeds. But I wrote an article for them saying, this is wonderful you're doing this, but we're not going to save the world just by saving Aunt Emma's tomato seeds. If we are going to make locally adapted seeds, somebody has to do some breeding. And I wrote an article sharing my story about what I did at Painted Mountain, combining 100 different lines together and adapting it to my climate and exciting other people to do that. And then I got invited all over the nation to give talks at the early beginning of the baby sustainable seed movement. And I think my job, there are a lot of people contributed a lot of things to this movement, but my job was to excite people about actually breeding these old-time crops and developing new things from them. And so the best advice I got along the way was when you're introducing a new line into your population, like say somebody, you found out that somebody saved some seeds from an Indian tribe and they had they're adapted to difficult situations. That's something you like, you want to combine it to your corn. You don't just plant it among ears and turn it loose. They've got lots of people doing that. It's kind of a fad. It's really exciting. You get 12 different kinds of corn and plant them and let them all mix. That's not the best way to go about it. What I do is I take the new line and I plant a row of it and I detassel it so that I can observe it. And I'll see that a couple of the plants will do really good and many of the plants really aren't good. So I did not spread the bad pollen. I take the ones that did good and I replant, I breed from them, not just the whole population. And I will self-pollinate them the next few years and continue selecting up the best genes from them. And then I turn them loose into my population. They make they add more genetic diversity. They throw in some more new traits. I keep doing that all the time. I'm adding to Painted Mountain, but if you just take a primitive line and intermix it, you're bringing in a bunch of bad traits as well as good ones. So don't just mix everything up.
Excellent. This is great advice because quite a few people have talked about saving seeds, but nobody's really given such good advice on like how to go about it. And I love the way you're so scientific and like organized about it, because definitely not one of my strong points, but something I could use some help with. And especially like next week at school, we're going to talk about how to be scientists and how to form experiments. Uh-huh. So I'll have a little more knowledge for my kids. Now, I was just going to ask you something. I don't know. All right, I'll have to think of it again. What's your favorite tool? So was that your favorite tool, that weeder, that sharp forky thing, or do you have a different favorite tool? Like if you had to move and could only take one tool with you, what could you not live without?
It'd be a hoe.
Okay.
Yeah, because I'm always hoeing all summer long. But I plant my corn far enough apart that I can take a rototiller down it. When you've got a lot of weeding to do, a hoe can just take forever, and a rototiller can kill weeds a lot better, a lot faster.
You plant your corn far enough apart, you can fit a rototiller between each row?
Correct.
So, like, I always thought corn had to be grown, like, kind of in a block so it didn't fall. Oh, that's what I was going to say. Mike read an article about you, is how he got your seed to begin with. I want to say, was it in Organic Gardening? I'm not sure where he read it, but that was where we got the first seed, was he read an article somewhere. Sorry. Okay, so wait. So doesn't corn have to be grown in a block or no? Or is it just such a big block you can fit a rototiller between the rows?
The reason you plant corn in a block is so that everything will get pollinated. If you were to plant corn just long row and a wind comes up, the pollen all blows away. If you plant it in a block, every corn plant is surrounded by neighbors that have pollen, and you're more likely to get all the kernels pollinated. I plant in rows. I think most people plant in rows. And you can just, the rows for me are 42 inches apart, and my rototiller can go right between them. and stay about 7 inches away from the roots side. That way I kill the weeds in between the rows. Then my corn is usually planted 10 or 12 inches apart within the row, and because you can't, the rototiller will not get close to them, you have to take a hoe and actually weed around the plants. Or if you have bindweed, you have to use your little asparagus tool and bend down, break your back, and dig all of them up so you've got them all.
Okay. Do you have a favorite internet resource?
No. There's some really cool YouTubes, though.
That works.
I don't have the address for you right now, but there's these people of Sustainable Seed. They put out a YouTube video on how to grind corn into flour, and that is just amazing.
Excellent. My husband really wants to do that, so that'll be great to find that for him. And I'll put the link in the show notes.
The guy says, and look at this painted mountain flower corn. Look how soft that is. It's fluffy and soft.
Cool. Okay, I have the right one. Nice. Do you have any business advice for listeners about, I mean, I know you're doing most of your work for free, but do you have any kind of, like, you must do some kind of, I mean, a partnership with Oli, so.
Yeah, okay. I do 10 months out of the year, I just work for advancement, and that includes wintertime. I'm hand-selecting seeds, one kernel at a time for every acre planted. It takes a long time, but I have to make some money. And at Bob Quinn's, we grow 2 acres worth of Painted Mountain, and I make money off of that. That gets sold all over the United States to all the big seed companies, and they repackage it and sell it largely for ornamental corn, although many, many people buy it for food as well. And business advice. And it took a long time to build up, really. They want you to have a dependable crop, and it's really tough if you have a bad year. If the hail destroys it, or there's a drought, or blackbirds get it, or something like that. You have to have customers that are willing to put up with a small crop or none 1 year. If you get large scale on corn, it takes a lot of equipment. I could go on forever about that. You have to be able to dry thousands of pounds of corn. Oli made a genius dryer that really works good. Spent a lot of time packaging it. It's really, I think Painted Mountain might be the biggest selling ornamental corn in the United States of the world. But it takes a lot of time and a lot of equipment to get there. It's so easy to have a herd of deer come in and wipe out your crop, or birds, or a storm, or something like that. They say that a farmer is lucky to make profit 1 year out of 10. It's better than that. That's just a folk thing. But there've been several years that I've lost almost everything. It's really hard, and it's really vulnerable, and for all the work I do, I just eke out a living. I don't know, going big on ornamental corn is a lot of work. You need a big setup. You need fences to keep the deer out. You need to know how to cultivate it and everything.
But 2 acres isn't that huge of a place, is it?
No. And, you know,
does he harvest that with a machine, or does he do that by hand?
Oh, no. No, the Painted Mountain corn can't be harvested by machine. We've got to do it by hand, and it's really, really hard to get a crew. I end up doing a lot of it all by myself. Young people, it sounds really fun. They get out there after an hour, and they say, well, I think I have something else to do. So, well, I'll give you some more money. No. I'll give you a lot more money. No. It's stoop labor. It's hard to find people to do stoop labor today.
Now, how come the corn's so low to the ground? They're just short plants.
Yeah, they're short, efficient, stress-hardy plants. Their plants are probably average 4.5 feet tall. And I am breeding the ears to get them as high as I can on the plant, but there's only so much you can do working with nature. Right. The Indian corn originally, the ears were coming right out of the ground.
Really?
And they don't blow over in the wind. The ears are more protected from the hail and the hailstorm. So nature made them that way. Of course, you have to be able to make sure the animals don't get in because it's easy to grab something right off the ground.
Yeah.
But I've made the plants taller, stronger, and moving the plants higher up the stalk.
Reminds me of picking green beans. Mike was picking green beans all this week. I always think they're tough because they're right on the ground like that.
You know, for business advice, it's really a lot of work and a lot of dedication to try and make a living off of one crop, corn anyway. I think it would be, unless you can give your entire life to it in long hours, I would say it'd be a better supplemental income. Pick something that doesn't take your whole life in order to make a living.
Okay. Are you ready for my final question?
Sure.
Okay. If there's one change you would like to see to create a greener world, what would it be? And this can be your corn, like, and growing, because it sounds like that's basically what you're after, is trying to create a corn that'll grow, but that's resilient to climate change. But, you know, got to ask my question. So, for example, like, is there a charity or organization you're passionate about, or project you'd like to see put into action, or your project that you want to spread? Like, what do you feel is the most crucial issue facing our planet in regards to the environment, either locally, nationally, or on a global scale?
Okay, the first part of your question, yes, I am bringing this corn to be a solution for the world, because corn is just a huge, huge, huge crop, and the way it's grown now is sucking life out of the soil. It's destroying our topsoil. And when we send food aid corn around to starving nations, I've tested that stuff, and it's got only like 8% protein, and my Painted Mountain's is 12-14. So we're feeding people stuff that's starving them. We're not really helping the world as much as we think we are. When I give people, let's say, I'll give you a real life example.
Okay.
We sent corn to Siberia, and I'm going to round off numbers to make this easy. Mm-hmm. But they did a yield trial, and their Siberian corn produced 115 bushels an acre. It's grown there forever. I sent them Painted Mountain. It grew. It produced 100 bushels an acre.
Wow.
I sent them, that's less than theirs. I sent them 6 of the best commercial corns for a cold climate, and they produced about 100 bushels an acre. Okay, the second year, they planted the Painted Mountain corn that did good for them, realizing that there's a lot of genetic diversity in it. Some did good, some bad. The second year of Painted Mountain jumped up to 126 bushels an acre. The first year, it surpassed their native corn. And it probably would keep climbing as they continue to select. The commercial corn went down to 40 bushels an acre because it's a hybrid. It goes good for 1 year and then it falls apart. Mm-hmm. And so if they wanted to grow commercial corn, they would have to keep buying it year after year after year. When I give a country a handful of Painted Mountain, they can multiply it, give it to their neighbors. They never have to buy another kernel. It keeps adapting more and more. So I am doing this as a way to give people a way to feed themselves so they don't have to keep supporting big industry, and their crops will not demolish the soil.
Nice.
What do I see happening? I've experienced huge global warming in my life starting about the year 2000. It's just going fast as a locomotive train. I think there's going to be real problems in the future, a lot faster than they predicted. When I first started growing corn in Montana, I was trying to get the most cold-hardy corn in the world. I was even getting corn from the Andes of Peru way up high with cold-hardy genes. But by about the year 2000, we're going in the opposite direction with hotter summers. Heat tolerance has become really important rather than cold tolerance. But, you know, my cold-tolerant foundation of Painted Mountain is still very viable because you can plant it in early spring when other corns can't be planted. People write that it endures frost and freezes and dies off and comes back. It's really tough. And with increasing climate trouble, the faster you can get a crop in the ground and harvested, the better, because it's not vulnerable to migrating birds or hailstorms or whatever. So it's got a quick maturity. It's aided by a early season cold tolerance, but also it's become drought and heat hardy tolerant. And I've watched the climate changing. We used to have 90 days. Now I used to plant June 1st and probably still see a frost, have harvest by September 1st because it'll freeze solid and die. So that was 90 days. Now I can plant 1st of May or earlier, and I don't have to harvest till October before we get a solid freeze. Not every year, but a lot of years. That's a month on each end. Our growing season is two months longer. Maybe some light frost, but that is a huge, huge change. And other farmers are changing their crops to deal with the increasing heat. If you listen to radio, correct. Well, you know, some places there's more rain.
Right. But here in
some
Montana,
places there's less. Here, the rain's been pretty steady, but in many years it has not rained in the summer when the corn needs it.
Mm-hmm.
But that is, we have experienced a drought that way and horrid hailstorms. 3 years ago, I had a total loss in six of my crops in six different counties and six different. We had dollar golf ball, ping pong ball sized hailstorms. I've never seen anything like that. It's nuts. The climate is changing, and so we have to get the crops in the ground and out faster. We're gonna have to worry about disease tolerance because the diseases. The diseases in the southern part of the world where things are moisture are moving up. North, as the north gets warmer and more diseases are coming here.
And the bugs, like the stink bugs don't die in the winter. We're getting bugs. Like, that's part of why I think all those trees are red over by Helena, too, and I worry about them coming here. Because the bugs can survive our winters where they used to not be able, and they would die off in the winter. We're not getting that cold, and not for as long, if we get it at all.
Well, if you listen to the news, the fossil fuel companies are putting so much money into publicity telling us not to worry about global warming. You've even got politicians that have been bought out by them and under their control. That is my big fear, is the political system that is preventing us from fixing the climate change. And we're not having much luck in stopping it. So my solution is to change the crops, and I'm not the only one. Big ag industry is breeding things for the changing climate. The people who are feeding America know that there's climate change. That's critical.
I just got to ask, so do you have anything to say about what's going on with the Lakota Sioux right now over in North Dakota, where they're trying to stop the pipeline and they're shutting down the protesters?
No, I don't have time to follow the news right now, but I think I would tend to be on the Lakota side.
Because the pipeline doesn't actually run through their reservation, but it runs on where their water supply is. And so all their water, if there's a leak or any kind of a problem with it, is going to contaminate all their water. And so they're trying to prevent it from being, I think it's going through Nebraska, from South Dakota or North Dakota down to Nebraska. And they're... this weekend they were just showing all sorts of videos of them, like, attacking them with dogs. It's very strange.
Really?
Yeah. So, and they're just trying to, because they have like private security people and they have all these people like standing around with dogs on leashes and they're actually like letting the dogs lunge at them. And it's just very strange. And they're just trying to prevent this pipeline from going through because they're worried about the water for their children.
So. Yeah, they should. You know, I've lived long enough that I've heard so many promises about this is not going to leak into your water supply, or this nuclear plant is not going to have a leakage. I've heard so much of those promises and seen so many failures. We have so many contaminated water supplies in America anyway. We can't take much more of this.
Mm-mm. Okay. So how did people connect with you? And if they were interested in contacting you about maybe working on one of your projects, or they had some land or something, how do they connect with you?
Well, thanks for asking that. Best thing would be to call me on the telephone. And my number is area code 406-930-1663. I'll repeat that, 406-930-1663. And you can also get me on email. My email address is buckskin, that starts with a B, BUCKSKIN at MTINTOUCH.net. That spells out buckskin at MT for Montana, intouch.net.
Excellent.
I love to help people. I love it when people tell me their experience with growing corn, how it did for their climate. If they live on the rainy West Coast, what problems do they have? How can I change things to work better for them? I would like to see people adapting Painted Mountain to their own region for their specific weather needs, and I can help them teach people how to select. And if you talk about my website, the website is outdated because it disappeared for some reason for several years, and it suddenly popped back up on. It's out of date, but there's still enough information to inspire you. I hope to update that again someday, and the website is www.seedweneed.com.
And can they order, like if they wanted to order a packet of seeds, is that where they go? Oh, can they buy seeds from there, or where can they buy seeds?
Good question. No, they don't order from that website.
Okay.
If you Google Painted Mountain Corn, you can find several many companies selling it.
Okay.
Those companies are also listed in the website, but you can Google that and find it in a minute. I spend hours and hours and hours on genetics. I absolutely do not have time to package up seed and keep track of money and mailing and all that, so don't come to me to buy seed. If you're interested in a large amount, give me a call.
What's a large amount?
Well, let's see. Well, if somebody wanted 50 pounds or something, call me.
Okay.
Or maybe in 10 pounds. But I can't handle all the mail orders.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I'm not good at that. I'm not good. I'll get it all messed up.
That's a lot of work. So I'll find some links and put some links in the show notes so people can order them. And if anybody wants like a big quantity, they've got your phone number and they can call you or email you. Well, thanks so much, Dave, for talking with me today, especially on Labor Day. You're supposed to have a day off, and instead you're here promoting and teaching all of us and inspiring us to make a change, because you've dedicated your life to saving our planet and creating a high-protein food that will, you know, help people all over the world live a better life. So
okay.
Thank you.
I have my profound closing quote.
Okay.
Don't forget the fun factor. There we go. That's me.
I think that's a great way to end it.
Okay.
Well, thanks, Dave. Did you know that you could support the Organic Gardener podcast without doing anything differently? If you're going to buy something on Amazon.com, since I'm an Amazon affiliate, if you go to Amazon through a link on my page, which every book that is listed on my website is linked to Amazon.com, you don't have to buy that book, but anything you buy that day from Amazon will give me a very, very small commission. but I got to tell you, it would sure help pay for, you know, just some of the basics it costs to keep the podcast up there. So if you like what you hear and you did want to give me just a little bit of support, that would be a great way for you to do it. If you're already going to Amazon to purchase something, like I said, all the books are linked up to because I am an Amazon affiliate. And so just if you didn't know anything, you don't have to buy that specific book, but just if you go to Amazon through my website, they do still give me a commission. So thanks for your support. If you know somebody who would benefit from the Organic Gardener podcast, we would just love it if you would share it with a friend. Thanks again for listening, and remember to grow.